3. The Invisible Revolution. The death of the contemporary forms of social order ought to gladden rather than trouble the soul. But what is frightening is that the departing world leaves behind it not an heir, but a pregnant widow. Between the death of one and the birth of the other, much water will flow by. A long night of chaos and desolation will pass. Alexander Herzen, On the Failure of the 1848 Revolutions. Did you ever ask yourself how it happens that government and capitalism continue to exist in spite of all the evil and trouble they are causing in the world? The anarchist Alexander Berkman wrote in his essay, The Idea is the Thing. If you did, then your answer must have been that it is because the people support those institutions and that they support them because they believe in them. Revolutions, when they begin, are invisible, at least to the wider society. They start with the slow discrediting and dismantling of an old ideology and an old language used to interpret reality and justify power. Human societies are captive to and controlled by language. When the old ideas are shattered, when it is clear that the official words and ideas no longer match the reality, the institutions that buttress the ruling class deflate and collapse. Our battle is a battle over what the experimental psychologist and linguist Steven Pinker refers to as mutual knowledge. Human beings do not live in the objective world alone, nor alone in the world of social activity as ordinarily understood, but are very much at the mercy of the particular language which has become the medium of expression for their society, the linguist Edward Sapir writes. It is quite an illusion to imagine that one adjusts to reality essentially without the use of language, and that language is merely an incidental means of solving specific problems of communication or reflection. The fact of the matter is that the real world is to a large extent unconsciously built up on the language habits of the group. We see and hear and otherwise experience very largely as we do because the language habits of our community predispose certain choices of interpretation. Our inability as citizens to influence power in a system of corporate or inverted totalitarianism, along with the loss of our civil liberties, weakens the traditional political vocabulary of a capitalist democracy. The descent of nearly half the country into poverty or near poverty diminishes the effectiveness of the rhetoric about limitless growth and ceaseless material progress. It undermines the myth of American prosperity. The truths are dimly apparent, but we have yet to sever ourselves from the old way of speaking and formulate a new language to explain us to ourselves. Until this happens, the corporate state can harness the old language like a weapon and employ the institutions of power and organs of state security to perpetuate itself. In the prison notebooks, Antonio Gramsci calls such a moment in history an interregnum, a time when the reigning ideology is bankrupt but has yet to be replaced by a new one. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born, and in this interregnum a great variety of morbid symptoms appear, Gramsci writes. We have been captivated in the modern age by what John Ralston Saul calls a theology of pure power, built on organization, technology, and information. Our new priest, he writes, is the technocrat. The man who understands the organization makes use of the technology and controls access to the information, which is a compendium of facts. These technocrats have rendered powerless the law, which is no longer used as it was designed to protect the individual from the unreasonable action of others, especially those in power. It is a weapon of injustice wielded by those who have married the state and the means of production. This marriage, Saul notes, makes it almost impossible for the law to judge illegal that which is wrong. The cult of rationality in the hands of technocrats has become an absolutist ideology. Technocrats, Saul notes, are slaves to dogma and hedonists of power. This cult presents itself as the solution to the problems it perpetuates, as if the fossil fuel industry could solve the energy crisis or global banks the financial crisis. Saul warns that if we do not free ourselves from this cult, And like Pinker and Berkman, he believes that this is only possible once we develop a new language to describe reality, we will be vanquished by these technocrats. Their obsession with structures and their inability or unwillingness to link these to the public good make this power an abstract force, a force that works, more often than not, at cross purposes to the real needs of a painfully real world, he writes. The Austrian writer Stefan Zweig, in his 1942 novella Chess Story, chronicles the arcane specializations that have created technocrats unable to question the systems they serve, as well as a society that foolishly reveres them. Mirko Centović, the world chess champion, represents the technocrat. His mental energy is invested solely in the 64 squares on a chessboard. Apart from the game, he is a dolt, a monomaniac, like all monomaniacs, who burrow like termites into their own particular material to construct in miniature a strange and utterly individual image of the world. When Centović senses an educated person, he crawls into his shell. That way, no one will ever be able to boast of having heard him say something stupid or having plunged the depths of his seemingly boundless ignorance. An Austrian lawyer known as Dr. B., who had been held by the Gestapo for many months in solitary confinement, challenges Centović to a game of chess. During his confinement, the lawyer's only reading material was a chess manual, which he memorized. He reconstructed games in his head. Forced in captivity to replicate the single-minded obsession of the technocrat Centović, Dr. B also became trapped inside a specialized world. But unlike Centović, P went insane, focusing on a tiny, specialized piece of human activity. His insanity returns once he challenges the chess champion. Zweig, who mourned for the broad, liberal culture of educated Europe, swallowed up by fascism and modern bureaucracy, warns of the absurdity and danger of a world run by technocrats. For Zweig, the rise of the industrial age and the industrial man and woman is a terrifying metamorphosis in the relationship of human beings to the world. As specialists and bureaucrats, human beings become tools, able to make systems of exploitation and even terror function efficiently without the slightest sense of personal responsibility or understanding. They retreat into the arcane language of all specialists to mask what they are doing and give to their work a sanitized, clinical veneer. This is Hannah Arendt's central point in Eichmann in Jerusalem. Technocratic human beings are spiritually dead. They are capable of anything, no matter how heinous, because they do not reflect upon or question the ultimate goal. The longer one listened to him, Arendt writes of Eichmann on trial, the more obvious it became that his inability to speak was closely connected with an inability to think, namely to think from the standpoint of somebody else. No communication was possible with him, not because he lied, but because he was surrounded by the most reliable of all safeguards against the words and presence of others, and hence against reality as such. Zweig, horrified by a world run by technocrats, committed suicide with his wife in 1942. He knew that from then on it was the Centovićes who would be exalted in the service of state and corporate monstrosities. Resistance, as Berkman points out, is first about learning to speak differently and abandoning the vocabulary of the rational technocrats who rule. Once we discover new words and ideas through which to perceive and explain reality, we free ourselves from neoliberalism, which functions, as Benjamin knew, like a state religion. This effort will take place outside the boundaries of popular culture and academia, where the deadening weight of the dominant ideology curtails creativity and independent thought. Subcomandante Insurgente Marcos, the spokesman for the Zapatistas, Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, or EZLN, announced in May 2014 that his rebel persona no longer existed. He had gone, he said, from being a spokesman to a distraction. His persona had fed an easy and cheap media narrative and turned a social revolution into a cartoon for the mass media, he explained. This persona had allowed the commercial press and the outside world to ignore traditional community leaders and indigenous commanders and wrap a movement around a fictitious personality. His persona, Marcus said, had trivialized a movement. The entire system, but above all its media, plays the game of creating celebrities who it later destroys if they don't yield to its designs, Marcos declared. The Zapatistas formed the most important resistance movement of the last two decades. They were a refreshing departure from the dreary, jargon-filled rhetoric of the Stalinist third-worldist sections of the old radical left. The Zapatistas recaptured the language of poetry, art, lyricism, and humor, and became a visible counterweight to the despoiling of the planet and the subjugation of the poor by global capitalism. They repeatedly reinvented themselves, as Marcos did, to survive. The Zapatistas gave global resistance movements a new language, drawn in part from the indigenous communal Mayan culture, as well as from the writings of figures such as Eduardo Galeano and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Offering a new paradigm for action, they understood that corporate capitalism has launched a war against us, and they showed us how to fight back. Neoliberalism, this doctrine that makes it possible for stupidity and cynicism to govern in diverse parts of the earth, does not allow for inclusion other than that of subjugation to genocide, Marcos wrote in an open letter in May 12, 1995. Die as a social group, as a culture, and above all, as a resistance. Then you can be part of modernity, say the great capitalists from the seats of government to the indigenous campesinos. These indigenous people irritate the modernizing logic of neo-mercantilism. Their rebellion, their defiance, their resistance irritates them. The anachronism of their existence within a project of globalization, an economic and political project that soon will decide that poor people, all the people in opposition, which is to say the majority of the population, are obstacles. The armed character of "we are here" of the Zapatista indigenous people does not matter much to them, nor does it keep them awake. A little fire and lead will be enough to end such imprudent defiance. What matters to them and bothers them is that their very existence, in the moment that they, the indigenous Zapatistas, speak out and are heard, is converted into a reminder of an embarrassing omission of neoliberal modernity. These Indians should not exist today. We should have put an end to them before. Now, annihilating them will be more difficult, which is to say, more expensive. This is the burden which weighs upon neoliberalism made government in Mexico. Let's resolve the causes of the uprising, say the negotiators of the government, leftists of yesterday, the shamed of today, as if they were saying, all of you should not exist. All of this is an unfortunate error of modern history. Let's resolve the causes is an elegant synonym of we will eliminate them. For this system which concentrates wealth and power and distributes death and poverty, the campesinos, the indigenous, do not fit in the plans and projects. They have to be gotten rid of, just like the herons and the eagles have to be gotten rid of. The Zapatistas began by using violence, but they soon abandoned it for the slow, laborious work of building 32 autonomous, self-governing municipalities. Local representatives from the Juntas de Buen Gobierno, Councils of Good Government, which is not recognized by the Mexican government, preside over these independent Zapatista communities. The councils oversee community programs that distribute food, set up clinics and schools, and collect taxes. Resources are for those who live in the communities, not for the corporations that come to exploit them. And in this, the Zapatistas allow us to see the future, a future where we have a chance of surviving. The future was created, and now its creators, the Zapatistas, are destroying it, Subcomandante Marcos said to roughly 1,000 people who turned out late in the evening of May 24, 2014, in the village of La Realidad for a memorial for a Zapatista teacher, José Luis Solís López, who had been murdered by Mexican paramilitary members. And we saw that now the full-size puppet, the character, the hologram, was no longer necessary. Time and time again we planned this, and time again we waited for the right moment, the right calendar and geography to show what we really are to those who truly are. The murder of the teacher, known by his nom de guerre as Galliano, 3 weeks earlier on May 2, appears to have been part of a drive by a government-allied paramilitary group, SUAC H, to assassinate rural Zapatista leaders and destroy the self-governing Zapatista enclaves. The Fray Bartolomé Human Rights Center said that 15 unarmed Zapatista civilians were wounded on May 2. In other attacks that day, a Zapatista clinic was destroyed and a school and 3 vehicles were damaged. The address was the first public appearance by Marcos since 2009. In a downpour, he spoke to the crowd into the early hours of May 25. He has been the public face of the Zapatistas since the group emerged as an insurrectionary force on January 1, 1994, in Chiapas, the southernmost state of Mexico. Marcos, who is mestizo rather than Mayan, spoke about his rise as a media figure following the uprising and how the movement had catered to the demands for an identifiable leader by a press that distorts reality to fit into its familiar narratives. Just a few days later, after the uprising, with the blood of our fallen soldiers still fresh in the city streets, we realized that those from outside did not see us. Accustomed to looking at the indigenous from above, they did not raise their eyes to look at us. Accustomed to seeing us humiliated, their heart did not understand our dignified rebellion. Their eyes were fixed on the only mestizo they saw with a balaclava, that is to say, one they did not look at. Our bosses told us they only see their own smallness. Let's make someone as small as them so they may see him, and through him they may see us. A complex maneuver of distraction began then, a terrible and marvelous magic trick, a malicious play of the indigenous heart that we are, the indigenous knowledge challenging modernity in one of its bastions, the media. The character called Marcos started then to be built. The clandestine movement began, like all rebellions, with a handful of idealists. When the first group arrived in 1983-1984, we were in the densest part of the jungle, Marcos said in Remembering 10 Years of Zapatismo, a documentary produced by the Chiapas Independent Media Center and Free Speech Radio News. We are talking about a group of 4 or 5, 6 people that repeated to themselves every day, "This is the right thing to do, the right thing to do." There was nothing in the world telling us this was the right thing to do. We were dreaming that someday all of this would be worth something. Early on January 1, 1994, armed rebels took over 5 major towns in Chiapas. It was the day the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, came into effect. The EZLN announced that it no longer recognized the legitimacy of the Mexican government. In denouncing NAFTA as a new vehicle to widen the inequality between the global poor and the rich, the EZLN showed an understanding of free trade agreements that many in the United States lacked. It said it had resorted to violence because peaceful means of protest had failed. The Mexican government, alarmed and surprised, sent several thousand members of the military and police to Chiapas to crush the uprising. The military handed out food to the impoverished peasants. It also detained scores of men. Many were tortured. Some were killed. In 12 days of heavy fighting, about 200 people died. By February, the Zapatistas, who had hoped to ignite a nationwide revolution and who were reeling under the military assault, agreed to negotiate. Most had retreated into the surrounding jungle. The insurgency, Marcos said at the memorial for his assassinated comrade, had faced a fundamental existential choice at that point. Should we prepare those who come after us for the path of death? Should we develop more and better soldiers? Invest our efforts in improving our battered war machine? Simulate dialogues and a disposition toward peace while preparing new attacks? Kill or die as the only destiny? Or should we reconstruct the path of life, that which those from above had broken and continue breaking? Should we have adorned with our blood the path that others have charted to power? Or should we have turned our heart and gazed toward who we are toward those who are what we are, that is, the indigenous people, guardians of the earth and of memory. Nobody listened then, but in the first babblings that were our words, we made note that our dilemma was not between negotiating and fighting, but between dying and living. And we chose. And rather than dedicating our lives to training guerrillas, soldiers, and squadrons, we developed education and health promoters who went about building the foundations of autonomy that today amaze the world. Instead of constructing barracks, improving our weapons, and building walls and trenches, we built schools, hospitals, and health centers, improving our living conditions. Instead of fighting for a place in the Parthenon of individualized deaths of those from below, we chose to construct life. All this in the midst of a war that was no less lethal because it was silent. The movement shift from violence to nonviolent civil disobedience, a shift that also took place within the African National Congress, ANC, was evidenced during the memorial. Zapatista leaders said they knew the identities of the vigilantes who had carried out the attacks. But those in the crowd were cautioned not to seek vengeance against the killers, who they were told had been manipulated to murder in the service of the state. The focus had to remain on dismantling the system of global capitalism itself. As happened with the ANC half a world away, the shift from violence to nonviolence was what gave the Zapatistas their resiliency and strength. Marcos stressed this point. Small justice looks so much like revenge. Small justice is what distributes impunity. As it punishes one, it absolves others. What we want, what we fight for, does not end with finding Galeano's murderers and seeing that they receive their punishment. Make no mistake, this is what will happen. The patient and obstinate search seeks truth, not the relief of resignation. True justice has to do with the buried compañero, Galeano. Because we ask ourselves not what do we do with his death, but what do we do with his life. This transformation by the EZLN is one that is crucial to remember as we search for mechanisms to sever ourselves from the corporate state and build self-governing communities. The goal is not to destroy, but to transform. And this is why violence is counterproductive. We too must work to create a radical shift in consciousness. We must, as the Zapatista slogan insisted, be a Zapatista wherever you are. And this will take time, drawing larger and larger numbers of people into acts of civil disobedience. We too must work to make citizens aware of the mechanisms of power. An adherence to nonviolence will not save us from the violence of the state or from the state's hired goons and vigilantes. But nonviolence makes conversion, even among our oppressors, possible. And it is conversion that is our goal. As Marcos said, maybe it's true. Maybe we were wrong in choosing to cultivate life instead of worshiping death. But we made the choice without listening to those on the outside, without listening to those who always demand and insist on a fight to the death, as long as others will be the ones to do the dying. We made the choice while looking and listening inward as the collective Votan that we are. We chose rebellion, that is to say, life. It was a brisk February morning in Oxford, England, when I left the McDonald Randolph Hotel, a stately Victorian Gothic building, on Beaumont Street. I walked along the narrow cobblestone streets past the storied colleges with resplendent lawns and Gothic stone spires to meet Avner Offer, an economic historian and Chicheley Professor Emeritus of Economic History at Oxford University. Offer, author of The Challenge of Affluence, Self-Control and Well-Being in the United States and Britain Since 1950, 2006, has explored for 25 years the cavernous gap between our economic and social reality and our ruling economic ideology. According to Offer, our ideology of neoclassical economics, the belief that, as E. Roy Weintraub wrote, people have rational choices among outcomes that can be identified and associated with values, that individuals maximize utility and firms maximize profits, and that people act independently on the basis of full and relevant information, is a just world theory. A just world theory posits that the world is just, people get what they deserve. If you believe that the world is fair, you explain or rationalize away injustice, usually by blaming the victim. But he warned, if we continue down a path of mounting scarcities, along with economic stagnation and decline, this neoclassical model becomes ominous. Major ways of thinking about the world constitute just world theories, he said. The Catholic Church is a just world theory. If the Inquisition burned heretics, they only got what they deserved. Bolshevism was a just world theory. If kulaks were starved and exiled, they got what they deserved. Fascism was a just world theory. If Jews died in the concentration camps, they got what they deserved. The point is not that the good people get the good things, but the bad people get the bad things. Neoclassical economics, our principal source of policy norms, is a just world theory. Offer quoted the economist Milton Friedman, "The ethical principle that would directly justify the distribution of income in a free market society is to each according to what he and the instruments he owns produces." So, Offer went on, everyone gets what he or she deserves, either for his or her effort or for his or her property. No one asks how he or she got this property, and if they don't have it, they probably don't deserve it. The point about just world theory is not that it dispenses justice, but that it provides a warrant for inflicting pain. Offer, a transplanted Israeli who came to Oxford after serving as a soldier in the 1967 war, said that the effectiveness of an ideology is measured by the amount of coercion it takes to keep a ruling elite in power. Reality, when it does not conform to the reigning ideology, he said, has to be forcibly aligned. The amount of coercion needed to make society adhere to the model is a rough measure of the model's validity. That the Soviet Union had to use so much coercion undermined the credibility of communism as a model of reality, he said. It is perhaps symptomatic that the USA, a society that elevates freedom to the highest position among its values, is also the one that has one of the very largest penal systems in the world relative to its population. It also inflicts violence all over the world. It tolerates a great deal of gun violence and a health service that excludes large numbers of people. As larger and larger segments of society are forced because of declining economies to become outsiders, the use of coercion under our current model will probably become more widespread. There are two core doctrines in economics, Offer said. One is individual self-interest. The other is the invisible hand, the idea that the pursuit of individual self-interest aggregates or builds up for the good of society as a whole. This is a logical proposition that has never been proven. If we take the centrality of self-interest in economics, then it is not clear on what basis economics should be promoting the public good. This is not a norm that is part of economics itself. In fact, economics tells us the opposite. Economics tells us that everything anyone says should be motivated by strategic self-interest, and when economists use the word strategic, they mean cheating. Offer argued that a silent revolution took place in economics in the 1970s. That was a time when economists discovered opportunism, a polite term for cheating, he said. Before that, economics had been a just world defense of the status quo. But when the status quo became the welfare state, suddenly economics became all about cheating. Game theory was about cheating. Public choice theory was about cheating. Asymmetric information was about cheating. The invisible hand doctrine tells us there is only one outcome, and that outcome is the best. But once you enter a world of cheating, there is no longer one outcome. It is what economists call multiple equilibria, which means there is not a deterministic outcome. The outcome depends on how successful the cheating is, and one of the consequences of this is that economists are not in a strong position to tell society what to do. The problem, he said, is that the old norms of economics continue to inform our policies as if the cheating norm had never been introduced. Let's take the doctrine of optimal taxation, he said. If you assume a world of perfect competition, where every person gets their marginal products, then you can deduce a tax distribution where high progressive taxation is inefficient. This doctrine has been one of the drivers to reduce progressive taxation. But looking at the historical record, this has not been accompanied by any great surge in productivity. Rather, it has produced a great surge in inequality. So once again, there is a gap between what the model tells us should happen and what actually happens. In this case, the model works, but only in the model, only if all the assumptions are satisfied. Reality is more complicated. Offer brought up one of the issues to consider. When those in authority, whether political, academic, or civic, are expounding their doctrines through Enlightenment idioms, we must ask, is this being done in good faith? And here I think the genuine insight provided by the economics of opportunism is that we cannot assume it is being done in good faith. According to Offer, economics, political science, and even philosophy, ever since rational choice swept through the American social sciences, have embraced the idea that an individual has no responsibility towards anyone except himself or herself. A responsibility to anyone else is optional. The public discourse, for this reason, has become a hall of mirrors. Our current economic model, he said, will be of little use to us in an age of ecological deterioration and growing scarcities. Energy shortages, global warming, population increases, and increasing scarceness of water and food will create an urgent need for new models of distribution. Our two options, he said, will be hanging together or falling apart. Offer argues that we cannot be certain that growth will continue. If standards of living stagnate or decline, he said, we must consider other models for the economy. Offer, who studied the rationing system set up in the countries that took part in World War I, suggested that we examine how past societies coped successfully with scarcity. He held up these war economies, with their heavy rationing, as a possible model for collective action in a contracting economy. In an age of scarcity, it will be imperative to set up new, more egalitarian models of distribution. Clinging to the old neoclassical model, he argued, could erode and perhaps destroy social cohesion and require the state to engage in greater forms of coercion. What you had in World War I was a very sudden transition to a serious scarcity economy that was underpinned by the necessity for sharing, he said. Ordinary people were required to sacrifice their lives. They needed some guarantee for those they left at home. These war economies were relatively egalitarian. These economics were based on the safety net principle. If continued growth in the medium run is not feasible, and that is a contingency we need to think about, then these rationing societies provide quite a successful model. On the Allied side, people did not starve. Society held together. Adam Smith, he noted, wrote that what drives us is not, in the end, individual selfishness, but reciprocal obligation. We care about other people's good opinions. This generates a reciprocal cycle. Reciprocity is not altruistic. That part of the economic core doctrine is preserved. But if we depend on other people for our self-worth, then we are not truly self-sufficient. We depend on the sympathy of others for our own well-being. Therefore, obligation to others means that we do not always seek to maximize economic advantage. Intrinsic motivations, such as obligation, compassion, and public spirit, crowd out financial ones. This model can also motivate a different type of political and economic aspiration. However, if we cling to our current economic model, which Offer labels every man for himself, then, he said, it will require serious repression. He concluded, there is not a free market solution to a peaceful decline. The revolutionary theorists of the past invested tremendous energy in looking for the triggers of revolt. Although nearly all were caught off guard by the eruption of the revolutions they championed and organized. Lenin said in January 1917, 6 weeks before the revolution that would bring him to power, "We of the older generation may not see the decisive battles of this coming revolution." It is impossible, as Lenin discovered, to predict the time and progress of revolution. It is governed by its own more or less mysterious laws, but when it comes, it moves irresistibly. The history of human thought recalls the swinging of a pendulum, which takes centuries to swing, the Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin said. After a long period of slumber comes a moment of awakening. Then thought frees herself from the chains with which those interested, rulers, lawyers, clerics, have carefully enwound her. She shatters the chains. She subjects to severe criticism all that has been taught her and lays bare the emptiness of the religious, political, legal, and social prejudices amid which she has vegetated. She starts research in new paths, enriches our knowledge with new discoveries, creates new sciences. But the inveterate enemies of thought, the government, the lawgiver, and the priest, soon recover from their defeat. By degrees, they gather together their scattered forces and remodel their faith and their code of laws to adapt them to the new needs. Lenin placed his faith in a violent uprising, in a professional, disciplined, revolutionary vanguard freed from moral constraints, and, like Marx, in the inevitable emergence of the worker state. Pierre-Joseph Proudhon insisted that gradual change would be accomplished as enlightened workers took over production and educated and converted the rest of the proletariat. Mikhail Bakunin predicted the catastrophic breakdown of the capitalist order, something we are likely to witness in our lifetimes, and new autonomous worker federations rising up out of the chaos. Kropotkin, like Proudhon, believed in an evolutionary process that would hammer out the new society. Emma Goldman, along with Kropotkin, came to be very wary of both the efficacy of violence and the revolutionary potential of the masses. The mass, Goldman wrote bitterly, echoing Marx, clings to its masters, loves the whip, and is the first to cry crucify. The revolutionists of history counted on a mobilized base of enlightened industrial workers or common laborers. The building blocks of revolt, they believed, relied on the tool of the general strike, the ability of workers to cripple the mechanisms of production. Strikes could be sustained with the support of political parties, strike funds, and union halls. Workers without these support mechanisms had to replicate the infrastructure of parties and unions if they wanted to put prolonged pressure on the bosses and the state. But today, with the decimation of the U.S. manufacturing base and the dismantling of our unions and opposition parties, we will have to search for different instruments of rebellion, as Lynn Stewart correctly observed. Our family farms have been destroyed by agro-businesses, and most manufacturing jobs have disappeared as our manufacturing base has moved overseas. Of those that remain, fewer than 12% are unionized. Unlike past revolutionary struggles in industrial societies, we cannot rely today on the industrial or agrarian muscle of workers. The dispossessed working poor, along with unemployed college graduates and students and unemployed journalists, artists, lawyers, and teachers, will form our movement, while workers in Asia and the global South, where our manufacturing is now located, will have to organize and fight the industrialists through the traditional tactics of strikes, work stoppages, and unionizing. The fight for a higher minimum wage is crucial to uniting service workers with the alienated college-educated sons and daughters of the old middle class in the United States. Bakunin would have recognized these pivotal déclassé intellectuals in the Occupy movement. Once they unite, those who have had their expectations dashed and concluded that they will not be able to rise economically and socially will become our triggers of revolt. This consciousness is part of the self-knowledge of service workers and fast food workers. It is also part of the consciousness of the swelling population of college graduates caught in a vice of low-paying jobs and obscene amounts of debt. Many of the urban poor have been crippled and broken by a rewriting of laws, especially drug laws, that has permitted courts, probation officers, parole boards, and police to randomly seize poor people of color, especially African American men, without just cause and lock them in cages for years. In many of our most impoverished urban centers, our internal colonies, as Malcolm X called them, mobilization will be difficult. Many African Americans, especially the urban poor, are in prison, on probation, or living under some kind of legal restraint. Charges can be stacked against them, and they have little hope for redress in the courts, especially as 97% of all federal cases and 94% of all state cases are resolved by guilty pleas rather than trials. A New York Times editorial recently said that the pressure employed by state and federal prosecutors to make defendants accept guilty pleas, which often include waiving the right to appeal to a higher court, is closer to coercion than to bargaining. Poor people of color are subject to daily abuse by omnipotent police forces. Police are permitted to strip them of their most basic rights and either authorized to use deadly force or protected by their departments and the legal system, in most cases when they do, even against unarmed suspects. The law professor Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, argues that we have created a criminal caste system. This caste system controls the lives of not only the 2.3 million people who are incarcerated, but the 4.8 million people on probation or parole. Millions more people are forced into permanent second-class citizenship by their criminal records, which make employment, higher education, and public assistance difficult or impossible. A Department of Defense program known as 1033, begun in the 1990s and authorized by the National Defense Authorization Act and federal Homeland Security grants to the states, have provided a total of $4.3 billion in military equipment to local police forces, either for free or on permanent loan, the magazine Mother Jones reported. The militarization of the police, which includes outfitting police departments with heavy machine guns, magazines, night vision equipment, aircraft, and armored vehicles, has effectively turned urban police, and increasingly rural police as well, into quasi-military forces of occupation. Police conduct up to 80,000 SWAT raids a year in the U.S., up from 3,000 a year in the early 80s, writes Han Ching Chen, the magazine's reporter. The American Civil Liberties Union, cited in the article, found that almost 80% of SWAT team raids are linked to search warrants to investigate potential criminal suspects, not for high-stakes hostage, barricade, or active shooter scenarios. The ACLU also noted that SWAT tactics are used disproportionately against people of color. The urban poor are already in chains. These chains are being readied for the rest of us. Maria J. Stefan and Erica Chenoweth examine 100 years of violent and nonviolent resistance movements in their 2008 article, Why Civil Resistance Works: The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. They conclude that nonviolent movements succeed twice as often as violent uprisings. Nonviolent movements appeal to those employed within the power structure, especially the police and civil servants, who are cognizant of the corruption and decadence of the power elite and are willing to abandon them. And, the authors point out, with as little as 3.5% of the population who are organized and disciplined, it is possible to bring down even the most ruthless totalitarian structures. While governments easily justify violent counterattacks against armed insurgents, regime violence against nonviolent movements is more likely to backfire against the regime, Stefan and Chenoweth write. Potentially sympathetic publics perceive violent militants as having maximalist or extremist goals beyond accommodation, but they perceive nonviolent resistant groups as less extreme, thereby enhancing their appeal and facilitating the extraction of concessions through bargaining. The ability to draw those within the systems of power into the movement creates paralysis and crippling divisions within the ruling elite. And this is fundamental to all successful revolts. Internally, members of a regime, including civil servants, security forces, and members of the judiciary, are more likely to shift loyalty toward nonviolent opposition groups than toward violent opposition groups, they write. The coercive power of any resistance campaign is enhanced by its tendency to prompt disobedience and defections by members of the opponent's security forces, who are more likely to consider the negative political and personal consequences of using repressive violence against unarmed demonstrators than against armed insurgents. Divisions are more likely to result among erstwhile regime supporters, who are not as prepared to deal with mass civil resistance as they are with armed insurgents. Regime repression can also backfire through increased public mobilization, actively involving a relatively large number of people in the nonviolent campaign may bring greater and more sustained pressure to bear on the target, whereas the public may eschew violent insurgencies because of physical or moral barriers. Although it appears, as I write this book, that political ferment is dormant in the United States, this is incorrect. Revolutions, when they erupt, are to the wider public sudden and unexpected, because the real work of revolutionary ferment and consciousness is, as Berkman observed, invisible. Revolutions expose their face only after revolutionary ferment has largely been completed. Throughout history, those who have sought radical change have always had to begin by discrediting the ideas used to prop up ruling elites and constructing alternative ideas and language. Once ideas shift for a large portion of a population, once the vision of a new society grips the popular imagination, once the old vocabulary no longer holds currency, the power elite is finished, although outwardly it may appear that nothing has changed. But this process is difficult to see and often takes years. Those in power are completely unaware that the shift is taking place. They will speak, like all dying elites, in the old language until they finally become figures of ridicule. In the United States today, no person or movement can program the ignition of this tinder. No one knows where or when the eruption will take place. No one knows the form it will take. But a popular revolt is coming. The refusal by the corporate state to address even the minimal grievances of the citizenry, its abject failure to remedy the mounting state repression, the chronic unemployment and underemployment, and the massive debt peonage that is crippling millions of Americans, and the widespread despair and loss of hope, along with the collapse of institutions meant to carry piecemeal and incremental reforms, including the courts, make blowback inevitable. Because revolution is evolution at its boiling point, you cannot make a real revolution any more than you can hasten the boiling of a tea kettle, Berkman wrote. It is the fire underneath that makes it boil. How quickly it will come to the boiling point will depend on how strong the fire is. If a nonviolent popular movement is able to ideologically disarm the bureaucrats, civil servants, and police, to get them, in essence, to defect, nonviolent revolution is possible. But if the state can organize effective and prolonged violence against dissent, then state violence can spawn reactive revolutionary violence, or what the state calls terrorism. Violent uprisings are always tragic, and violent revolutions always empower revolutionaries, such as Lenin and the Bolsheviks, who are as ruthless as their adversaries. Violence inevitably becomes the principal form of coercion on both sides of the divide. Social upheaval without clear definition and direction, without ideas behind it, swiftly descends into nihilism, terrorism, and chaos. It consumes itself. This is the minefield we will have to cross. The tyrant and his subjects are in somewhat symmetrical positions, wrote Thomas Schelling. They can deny him most of what he wants. They can, that is, if they have the disciplined organization to refuse collaboration. And he can deny them just about everything they want. He can deny it by using force at his command. They can deny him the satisfaction of ruling a disciplined country. He can deny them the satisfaction of ruling themselves. It is a bargaining situation in which either side, if adequately disciplined and organized, can deny most of what the other wants, and it remains to see who wins. By the time ruling elites are openly defied, there has already been a nearly total loss of faith in the ideas, in our case, neoclassical economics and globalization, that sustain their structures of power. The process of understanding this can take years, but once people do understand it, the slow, quiet, and peaceful social evolution becomes quick, militant, and violent, as Berkman explained. Evolution becomes revolution. I prefer the gradual reforms of a functioning liberal democracy. I fear the process of massive social engineering. I detest the poison of violence. I would rather live in a system in which our social institutions permit the citizenry to nonviolently dismiss those in authority and promote the common good, a system in which institutions are independent and not captive to corporate power. But we do not live in such a system. We live in a system that is incapable of reforming itself. The first step to dismantling that system is to dismantle the ideas that give it legitimacy. Once that is done, though the system may be able to cling to power through coercion and fear for years, it will have been given a mortal blow. Many ideas, once held to be true, have come to be regarded as wrong and evil, Berkman wrote. Thus, the ideas of the divine right of kings, of slavery and serfdom. There was a time when the whole world believed those institutions to be right, just, and unchangeable. In the measure that those superstitions and false beliefs were fought by advanced thinkers, they became discredited and lost their hold upon the people, and finally the institutions that incorporated those ideas were abolished. Highbrows will tell you that they had outlived their usefulness, and therefore they died. But how did they outlive their usefulness? To whom were they useful, and how did they die? We know already that they were useful only to the master class, and they were done away with by popular uprisings and revolutions.